there's value in diversity.
So you have race, ethnicity, gender, age, religion.
Think about diversity as strength.
Hello and welcome to UCHRI's inaugural podcast of Voices of Diversity. I'm your host, Gabriela Casares, a postdoctoral scholar here at the Institute. In this series, UCHRI brings together the perspectives and voices of underrepresented faculty, administrators, and students grappling with various issues linked to diversity and higher education. A bit of a disclaimer here, this is my first time editing a podcast, so please forgive some of the abrupt transitions. To kick off our opening podcast, we ask, what exactly is diversity? To begin, we turn to Assistant Professor of Sociology, Whitney Pirtle, from the University of California, Merced. What is diversity?
The concept of diversity is interesting and complex. I recently read a really good book called The Enigma of Diversity, and it outlined kind of its history over time and how it's become a buzzword that focuses more on the symbolic. Typically, when we're thinking about diversity, we're thinking about racial and ethnic diversity. So just having more numbers, increased numbers of people who are from historically underrepresented ethnic and racial groups.
So is it just confined to having physical bodies that are diverse? How does that conversation extend in the context of the classroom?
It should extend beyond representation and numbers. That doesn't actually make sense. Not a person themselves is not diverse. It's that a person might be different and have a different experience. Often we hear, we need a diverse candidate. Their worldview and how they're seen and doing in the world, and that diverse experience they bring to a certain place can be beneficial across many layers. But it's not just that one, it's not just that they bring the diversity, it's that set of experiences and attitudes that in combination with everybody else in the room might increase the conversation. So you might want a diverse candidate pool, not just individuals that are supposed to represent diversity. Because then what that does is means you're putting it all on these individuals that already are dealing with a lot of different things, and the world of academia are already overburdened by just service requests often at the hands of diversity. Like, we need someone to sit on this panel and talk to us about their work in the community. Or we need someone to even translate this into their home language. Like, those aren't things that are really often included in our job description, but they're things that I think many of people of color are asked to do on behalf of the university. And so I think that when we put the idea of diversity on individuals themselves, we're really missing the goal. We don't just want that representation, or we don't just want an individual here to represent diversity. We want the institution to be more equitable and inclusive for all individuals who might have, you know, once been underrepresented to come into these spaces, but and feel included, and that their voices matter, and that they're contributing to the type of institution they think they want to be at that is equitable and serving communities.
You pointed to a couple of very important points in terms of it's not just individualistic, right? It's not about this one candidate. And there's also a larger conversation in terms of accountability and like systematic issues that need to change and need to be acknowledged. The numbers aren't there, and they're not keeping up with the larger demographics of California, of UC Merced, and even if we talk about it within a larger national level.
How has your own pedagogy shifted to adapt to such a shifting demographic?
Something I'm thinking about just off the top of my head is the way that we are typically used to assigning assignments for students in the classroom. I really enjoy grading on paper. I like having a pen and marking out papers. But when you're at a university where so many people, so many students are working class, first gen, asking them to, you know, just assuming that they have access to printers and are wanting to spend their money doing those sorts of things means that I might have to rethink the way I'm grading papers and even assigning textbooks. Textbooks can be very expensive. They're always renewing them or updating them. And so those prices kind of stay high and are growing. And the first year I got to UC Merced, I assigned the textbook that I was used to using that I had assigned when I was at Vanderbilt, which has a much different student population. And immediately I heard from students some complaints about the textbook price, and the students made me aware of how much it cost and how it was a struggle to get that book and the new edition for a price that they could afford. And it made a lot of sense to me that they were having these problems. And so this time around, I decided to not assign that textbook. And instead, I found other books that were still really relevant and interesting. One that they can find at the university library's webpage for free using an ebook. Another one that has a PDF copy online. Another one that you can buy for less than $20 in a Kindle version or even audiobook, so students can listen to the text instead of having to read it. Even, you know, the types of assignments we assign, the types of books we assign, there's always ways to include the students in helping us think about what might be better and more inclusive towards them, given their certain position.
So in today's climate, especially considering how there's a lot of kind of polar divides, considering our current president,
how can safe spaces be created to help generate and foster these very crucial discussions, but at the same time, kind of avoid self-segregation?
Spaces are extremely important and valuable, especially in institutions of higher education. They allow individuals to come into a space and not have to guess whether it's inclusive or, you know, so it's a community and support and safety that I think is needed for students in this current political environment. For instance, on our campus, we recently learned that we have around 600 students who have DACA. And given the current announcement that DACA could be ended within the next 6 months, that increases the amount of fear that these students are dealing with on an everyday basis. And so they might need a space to come together with each other or with allies and other advocates to say, I am afraid of what is going to happen to myself. I want to finish. I want to get my degree. I want to have financial aid. I don't know what to do. Or I'm fearful for my friends and my family members. Can you share some resources? They have already put themselves out there by applying for DACA, and you know, they're already dealing with feelings of maybe being unwanted because of this type of legislation. So if we can provide a safe space for them to feel free to speak that worry and concern and get the support that they need, I think we should do that. And I think that that we might have to make that a separate space and say this room is open for these students and their allies at this time so that they can actually feel free and open to share their concerns and know that they will be protected, because they're already dealing with immense amount of fear. And I don't think we should make them have to deal with other layers when we have the opportunity to kind of support them in that manner. And these are types of statuses that maybe individuals don't want to disclose to everybody for real reasons, right? They don't want certain authorities to maybe come in contact, or they don't want individuals who might say hateful things. And I recently co-authored a paper on the mental health implications of receiving DACA. And we found significant improvements to mental health. So their levels of stress decreased, their negative emotions decreased, their fear of deportation decreased after having obtained DACA. And so these types of programs are important for helping these individuals health. And then, you know, when individuals are healthier, communities are healthier, and that can extend to the university campus. So, you know, we need to make sure that we're thinking about our students' well-being and their, you know, psychological and emotional health, and make sure that we can help foster that and increase, maybe even increase that. And I think if we do that, then we have a healthier, more positive campus community as a whole.
We are going to take a short break and continue our conversation. We are here with Jenny Kwong, Special Projects Administrator for the Office of the Chancellor at the University of California, Berkeley.
Thanks for having me.
So we just want to, I just want to start off with just asking you, what does diversity mean? What is it? Why is it important to acknowledge the fact that it is a complex thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that comes to mind when I think about diversity is strength. Why that matters in the world of education and the academy is whether we are capitalizing on that strength. You know, to me, my interest and research is based on the foundation that maybe not everyone agrees with, but it's a closed statement to me that there's value in diversity, period. Running a university is challenging in and of itself, and providing and living out our values is very challenging in and of itself. But I think we can best do that when we best understand who it is that we support and serve. And so to me, that is our students, who are increasingly more diverse in all ways, including their multiple identities and background and history, family history with education and access. When leadership believes and values that as a strength, as a value add, you know, that to me is like the optimal way to run a university. Without that, I think we lose out on that asset, and we lose out on how to most effectively lead. You know, if we cannot ourselves as leaders, as instructors, understand the communities and the students that we serve, then how can we actually best lead and capitalize on that asset?
One of the things that I also find really interesting, right, is the fact that when we do talk about issues of diversity, often it is focused on students and faculty, which are important issues, mm-hmm. but also obviously staff is very critical, a very critical component in that equation. So I just wanted mm-hmm. to ask you what initially drew your attention to the importance of staff diversity, and kind of digging further in to that particular understudied or an overlooked area.
Yeah, I think that it's fair to say that, and I can see why this understandably happens, because most universities and their missions have a variety of goals, but among them, one of them being the pursuit of knowledge. Right, and the access to knowledge. And so when people think about who delivers that, it naturally is, you know, the instructors and the faculty and the students that they work with. But, you know, as someone who is a non-academic staff person or employee in a university, you know, the folks who run the ship of the university, and not just run the ship, but I think, but really add to the mission, living out the mission of access and knowledge production and college student development, our staff. If I think about the nurses I went to in college, the counselors I saw, my academic advisor, the people in financial aid who helped me figure out how I was going to get through every semester, all the way to understanding the people who made sure I got paid for my millions of random jobs while working my way through school. Those are also people who added to my college experience. From my point of view, the college experience is not just curricular, but also co-curricular. And that's part of what, that's the holistic college experiences, things you learn in the classroom through your books and through what people think of as traditional mechanisms for learning, as well as like how do you develop as a human being at that age when you're still figuring out who you are and asserting your independence and in your individuality. And when I think about the people who help do that, it's the people who organize student clubs, it's the people who are in the residence halls making sure I'm okay. You know, all of those people add to the richness of a holistic college experience. So maybe this is not a critical audience, but I do feel like often in universities, staff are sort of the invisible constituent, you know. In addition to being part of the people who drive the mission of universities, many universities are also some of the largest employers in a community, right? We employ, in terms of non-academic staff, you know, a give and take about 10,000 people here on our campus alone. So, you know, what is our role and responsibility as an employer as well? You know, and are we doing the best to be equitable in the way that we hire, develop, promote, and advance staff? So, you know, what I was really looking for was similar to a lot of the research that has been done, quantitative research that has been done on women faculty, faculty of color, a variety of other sort of identities of faculty on their career, gaining careers in tenure track roles, as well as then progressing in tenure track roles. I was really interested to see how does that live out for non-academic staff? And so I wanted to sort of add to the portfolio of work by doing a study on, you know, what is the career progression, particularly of staff of color in large public universities? And do there appear to be ceilings at the lowest job classification up to the highest job classification? You have staff of color most extremely overrepresented at the bottom of those classifications, and then basically exponentially underrepresented by the time you get to senior management and cabinet levels. And if you look at the trends for white staff, it is the exact opposite. So that graph is on an XY chart, an X, right? Where you have for white staff, they are extremely underrepresented at the bottom and then exponentially extremely overrepresented at the top. And so for me, it was like, I was just interested in seeing what the data is. And over time, are we actually moving? And, you know, I found at Berkeley that depending on the race group, without some intervention in that general inertia of time, you will never reach representation, at least, you know, 100 plus years out.
So by acknowledging the fact that obviously there isn't a right answer, but the importance of garnering and constructing that heterogeneous workspace, right, is partly tied to what you noted as social capital. What are some of the ways in which Berkeley, for example, is helping to address and build these networks and build a path towards moving up and helping to address some of these numerous blockages in the pipeline?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are some more institutionalized programs that are in conversations that other universities have implemented, you know, leadership development programs for women or communities of color or whatever have you. People who care about this issue and aren't in positions to develop a program or, you know, have resources to sort of launch a network. But I will say that it's to me, I see progress and it butts up against then the challenge. And so sometimes progress is paired with challenge, but I think progress is in every hire and in every relationship. You know, there are formal and informal mentorship programs on this campus that I think are extremely important and valuable to ensuring not just that And to be honest, the mentors don't have to necessarily be people of color. I had the privilege of having white mentors on this campus who have helped give me awareness and access to get to where, you know, I am today. But I will say they have to be people who value diversity, right? And that they see me not just for my skills, but that there's an asset to the fact that people of my background, my multiple identities, there's just very few of us at the table, and that actually is a value add. It's not a compromise.
Based on your research, where is the glass ceiling with respect to student affairs personnel?
In general, the staff of color glass ceiling on this campus is at the mid-professional level, so non-supervisory, experienced professional level. And there's a few people who make it into the higher levels of professionals and then managers and so forth. So I think for those of us who are in those roles, we have a huge responsibility to engage with our communities and uplift their skills. And, you know, if anyone reaches out and says, you know, Jenny, I saw this job, I'm intimidated to apply for it, but, and I don't know anyone in this, you know, leadership team, but what do you think? You know, that is like a huge responsibility for if I don't have that connection, if I know someone, regardless of their identity, who might have that value of diversity, and I know that this person is a rising star, and if we lost that person, it would be a loss for the whole campus. That's on us, each and every relationship, to help people help each other get into to positions of influence. We should have all the effort put in that we can to having a diverse and rich candidate pool. Whether that candidate pool actually is able to be diverse is a whole other challenge. Hiring is only one step, because if the culture on campus doesn't reflect a value of retaining, developing, and promoting, I see this happen all the time. Really good staff, no matter who they are, if they are not developed and promoted and valued, they will leave, as they should, to somewhere else where they feel they will be more valued. So I feel like it's a combination of all of those things, you know.
The fact that the way you frame the barriers in terms of structural, historical, and institutional challenges is something that's very important when we're talking about folks who are responsible for doing the hiring, folks who are in these higher level positions. And that necessitates a difficult conversation, right? This recognition in the context of power structures, in terms of the privileges that we have coming and being able to be at the table. How can we generate and have these sometimes uncomfortable, but at the same time, very necessary conversations, especially when we do take a step back and think about today's political climate? It's much, much different than it was even a year ago or 2 years ago. And these conversations are all that much more critical.
I will say one of the things that has helped over the years is to not give up on the hard conversations. And to be honest, even giving myself permission to engage in difficult conversations about the value, or enlightening folks about, hey, did you know that this is happening on this campus, this trend of lack of diversity at the at least racial diversity in senior leaders, is realizing that for a lot of people, it actually isn't a struggle to engage in that conversation. And so it's actually, some of it has been sort of removing my own defenses or blockage about whether I think people care, you know, like, because this is happening, I want to sort of point fingers and blame, you know, in leadership, really do care and want to have the conversation about engaging in this. And I've had the fortune, you know, our current chancellor, you know, I had conversations with her about my dissertation, about even being on this podcast, and she's extremely supportive of this research. And that matters, you know, that gives me then, you know, I have less weight on my shoulders about now I can focus on the how, you know, versus like, this is convincing that this is an important issue. So to me, I think some of it is engaging in the hard conversations, but engaging it in such a way that is not, you know, arguing to the death about your principle. And I need to be forward thinking versus sort of feudalistic in my engagement. So I always try to think about that. You know, I can sort of have the I'm feeling down in feudalistic conversations with my inner circle. But, you know, when I'm in strategic conversations and we're figuring out, you know, hard conversations around the valuing diversity, especially in a time you mentioned it, you know, we're in extremely resource strapped times as a system. You know, if we wanted to do everything we thought we should do, we don't have money to do even the things that we have to do, right? In a lot of places. So remembering to engage in those conversations in such a way that it's, let's keep talking about this. I don't want to end the conversation here. Let's keep thinking about solutions that move the needle forward. Even if we can't do everything that we want to do, let's keep talking about it. And I think that's really important. I hope it's influential, but otherwise.
Yes, definitely. I think that's something I constantly remind myself of too, because especially as people of color in positions like this, right? It is kind of extra difficult conversations to continue to initiate and be a part of in a way that maybe other staff don't have to engage in at that same level. Not necessarily being always called to be, diversity issues obviously are something that are very important to both of us, right? I think are driving factors in our careers. But at the same time, you pointed out the fact that when we're talking about diversity issues, it's about that inclusive environment that doesn't just include people of color, right? I mean, it's about this larger conversation, right? It's about having mentors who are not always people of color, right? And that
yes.
And making sure that we challenge these preconception in terms of what diversity looks like, right? Because it's not just the physical bodies. It's about this larger recognition of power structures and how they work.
It can feel lonely. And so it's really important to find allies and to find mentors. And I will say, you know, sometimes your allies are not people who look like you or have the same experiences as you. They are people who recognize that your experience is uniquely enriched, but also challenging, especially in a system that was built off of, you know, white men and that whole system. Some of my experience is who I am as an individual and how I express and present, but some of it is also how I'm perceived. Right? We all know how those stereotypes can get in the way. And then there's just like, I don't know if you're familiar with Claude Steele's research on stereotype threat or imposter syndrome, you know, then you just start getting in your head like, oh, you know, I got to act old. I got to act smart. I got to act educated. I got to act like a man, you know?
Yeah, that's a dangerous space.
You get in this little space because people, I'm like, oh, are people perceiving me this way? Is that why they're responding this way? Yeah, you get really spirally quick. So, you know, making sure that you have people around you who can build up the affirmations and the confidence, you know, is really important.
I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up. Do you have any last comments you'd like to add?
No matter who you are, you're operating half the amount of resources you probably should, including staff. I just have great appreciation for the work that all the staff do on this campus. And thank you to you for having this topic included in your series.
Thank you so much for being a part of it. It's definitely been a very productive conversation. Welcome back. We're here today with Henry Lam, doctoral student of Chinese language and literature, and also a student council member for the Diverse Educational Community and Doctoral Experience, or DECADE, at the University of California, Irvine. Thank you for joining us today, Henry.
Thank you, Gabrielle. I'm really happy to be here.
So you've been very involved and active in the community at UCI. And here at Voices of Diversity, we like to definitely include various perspectives and positionalities, especially when it comes to such broad terms such as diversity. So let's go ahead and start there. So what is diversity?
I think an important part of diversity is establishing a sense of community. Because for me personally, when I started as a first year PhD student, I really didn't have a sense of belonging or a sense of having an academic lineage. I would walk into a classroom and feel that somehow I was disadvantaged or somehow I did not compare well with the rest of the other students. But what something like DECADE does, you know, through community meetings, through journal club, through all these different events and support from faculty and staff, is really give me that sense of belonging that helps me succeed in graduate school.
So you mentioned this very critical term, you said academic lineage, right? Yep. That has a lot of connotations, especially as it's tied to social capital. So a lot of times, first generation minority students, right, lack that social capital in academia, right? And you pointed to some of the ways in which community is very critical. And I would imagine community, obviously, on campus and off campus.
This is a very good question. And I will begin with what you talked about, social capital. I also like to think of it as intellectual capital. Yeah. So when a student who maybe from a disadvantaged socioeconomic background, enters the university as a doctoral student, he or she may not have the sort of intellectual capital that they need right off the bat to succeed. So just coming right into the experience, they may have, you know, certain struggles that the general population may not be able to identify with or assist with immediately. So, for example, at UCI, when I first came here, it was actually in the summer of 2014, and Graduate Vision did a really good job of letting me kind of get my feet wet and understand what the graduate experience is like even before starting the course. And so they gave me that extra intellectual capital I need and social capital I needed to kind of jumpstart my experience. The other aspect that you mentioned, too, was about the isolation of graduate school. And I think this is not just for students who identify as diverse, but graduate students across the board. I think according to a recent poll, 70% of graduate students at UCI, actually they reported to having some sort of depression or some sort of mental health issues. And I think this really speaks to isolating the graduate experience because students tend to believe there is no community, that they have to do this by themselves. But actually, they're already part of a really tightly knit and supportive community that can assist them in succeeding, and where diversity, excellence, and cultural differences can actually bring people.
You also touched upon another important point, right? That the ever almost ubiquitous imposter syndrome too, mm-hmm. right? And that's a real challenge, especially when you marry it with that critical statistic you just cited in the context of mental health, right? These are all definitely realities that add an additional challenge in terms of the doctoral experience in a lot of ways to speak to graduation rates and to counter that also attrition rates, right? And I know everyone's experience is very distinct in terms of building that community, but do you see, I know Decades, one of the programs that is offered in the case of UCI, are there other opportunities too? I mean, sometimes the networks are created formally, but sometimes also informally in the context of your experiences.
I think Decade does a really good job in modeling what a sort of inclusive graduate community can look like. I mean, at these community meetings, yeah, it's a place where, you know, students meet. You know, we don't have faculty really come in. We can meet, and we're not just venting. We are really thinking about the experience and the sort of implications of imposter syndrome, you know, feelings of doubt despite evidence of excellence. And I think in those places, students really tend to identify with one another and understand that, wow, it's not just me that's going through imposter syndrome or all these, you know, different challenges, but the community itself is also facing that struggle and developing solutions towards how to solve some of the issues that arise as you go through the graduate experience. And I understand too that among different schools at UCI, people have started what we'd like to call climate committees. So these are committees of faculty and students who are very concerned about inclusivity issues within their school. So one of our goals last year was actually to try and create a stronger sense of community, not just within Decade, but among the different schools at UCI. And the goal of these councils is to bring students together and really generate that community to help the graduate experience become, you know, more positive and more reinforcing for everyone.
Yeah, so spaces like Decade are very critical in the context of the kind of emotional, cultural health of graduate students, and recognizing the fact that these systemic issues are definitely multifaceted. And moreover, the context of having these spaces, right, where it's just a welcoming space where you can discuss these very difficult issues. But the reality is that not all spaces are necessarily as welcoming. And sometimes, especially in the context of today's political climate, the conversations are becoming kind of more challenging and seemingly have that productive conversation, right? One of the things you mentioned is that having a space, it's not just about venting, right? It's about having a productive conversation while at the same time acknowledging the fact that this is a structural issue, right? There's historical implication. There's institutional issues that are definitely still at.
I think it's important that to emphasize, especially a decade, you know, these sorts of communities and these sorts of councils are not meant to create an us versus them sort of dynamic. In fact, we invite people of different views, different perspectives to come in and speak, because we just hope that there is a culture of mutual respect, you know, whether you're on this side or the other side, and that we can have that organic conversation. Because definitely, especially within what I might call the rhetoric of diversity and inclusion, there is this tendency to ignore other perspectives, people who for some reason, you know, are against Title IX and sort of affirmative action initiatives. But why is there that perspective, and how can perspectives of diversity and inclusion versus this kind of other perspective come in contact in a positive and productive way? So I think that's a really good question. I don't necessarily have an answer, but I think the dialogue.
So how can universities continue to create a kind of a more inclusive environment, right? Whether we're talking about the classroom, whether we're talking about outside spaces like Decade, what can be?
I think at the administrative and faculty level, so faculty and administrators could listen a little bit more, just to really survey the terrain and better understand what some of the issues are for students who identify as diverse, or even international students. Basically, any student who thinks that, okay, somehow I'm being viewed as this other, I'm somehow being marginalized. And I think this issue also relates to the question of voice. When you enter an academic setting, perhaps you feel like you do not have your authentic voice all the time. In fact, sometimes maybe you have to sacrifice that authentic voice in order to sound a certain way, or to be quote unquote more academic. So I think that conversation needs to continue to happen among administrators, faculty, and students. Right? How do we improve the graduate experience? How do we better support our students who come in feeling that they have to do all this on their own? They have to do the PhD on their own. And there are already conversations about deans and associate deans meeting with faculty mentors who support diversity and students who identify as diverse. And I think a lot can come out of these conversations, a potential solution or a point of contact for administrators, faculty, and students as well.
I'm very interested or fascinated by the fact that you use this term, no authentic, the challenge of having this authentic voice, right? And feeling kind of pressured to perform in a very specific way. Can you elaborate a little bit more about
doctoral students, whether it's in the lab or whether you're doing research that is, you know, very writing intensive? I mean, these are often related to kind of the image that you have to produce in those settings. For example, in my own experience, yeah, my writing, it has a certain voice when it's not geared towards research or academic writing. But now that I'm here, right, in this doctoral experience, I do sometimes feel that I have to write a certain way in order to, to meet certain standards, and that's okay. And I feel that my voice can kind of come out in that way too, but there's a certain sacrifice that has to be made, right? I cannot say things a certain way or say things in the way that I usually like to speak, because that is not, I'll have to sort of, as graduate students, I'll have to sort of perpetuate this image of being productive, that somehow we have to be working all the time. And I think in that sense, having to perpetuate this image is also sort of taking away our authentic voices.
And as universities continue to change, and I think UCI is a very great example, because California is becoming more diverse. The University of California system is becoming more diverse. This year, UCI is attaining status as a Title V Hispanic Serving Institution with a large number of first generation students, which is wonderful. Those numbers are not necessarily reflected in the context of our doctoral students and graduate students. So how can universities continue to kind of adapt to these continually changing and just increasingly diverse environment?
I definitely think having these programs, right, these diversity inclusion groups and committees is definitely something should be there as the environments continue to change, right? But I was really fascinated by what you said earlier about, it was about the academic lineage, right? And how we have to, oftentimes students identify as diverse have to serve in ways that maybe, more other students may not have to serve in that capacity. And I do think this is a problem because, you know, there have been certain issues raised about, you know, okay, if you're a diverse student, do you have to also, okay, if you're a doctoral student, right, and you have to teach and you have to research and you also have to do some sort of service, how important is that service and how much does the university want you to get involved in that service? I said as a diverse student, you know, I was involved a lot. And yes, it was out of my own volition, but yeah, there was also some people in the administration did encourage me to do it, which is okay. I was happy to do it. But, you know, for certain students, you know, without that social capital and serving, being on these committees and being in these different committees may take away from their research and their teaching. And that's definitely a reality, which is something that's not really talked about. But we do have to put in extra labor in service, even though we may be struggling with teaching and researching.
Yeah, that's the invisible work, additional workload, right? That right. Sometimes makes it to the CV or that should be on the CV, but is not necessarily recognized at the same level in mm-hmm. terms of producing an article.
Right. And I do think that it's this whole issue of invisible labor is something that, you know, people with power may not want to talk about that much. Sometimes I think for students who do engage in sort of service in diverse groups may feel that they are pulling a certain line or pushing a certain agenda. But I try to remind people involved in students who are involved in diversity and inclusion initiatives and these groups is that, remember, don't forget that, you know, it is the student and your experience and your identity that's at the center. Even though, you know, you do have to negotiate between, you know, different sort of agendas that people have, you know, people in power may have.
And that wraps up our first podcast. A special thank you to our guest, Assistant Professor of Sociology, Whitney Pirtle from the University of California, Merced, Dr. Jenny Kwan, Special Projects Administrator for the Office of the Chancellor at the University of California, Berkeley, and Henry Lam, Doctoral Candidate with the Department of East Asian Languages and Literature at the University of California, Irvine. Stay tuned for our next installment of Voices of Diversity at the beginning of the month. For more information about UCHRI, please visit our website at uchri.org. We'll hope you'll join us again soon. In our upcoming podcast, we will hear from undocumented doctoral students and the repeal of the DACA program.